This episode of Film Scene is being brought to you by our new Zazzle store. For logoed shirts, mugs, and stickers, go to zazzle.com/filmscene.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's showtime.
This is Film Scene, the podcast for movie fans by movie fans. I'm your host, Tim Gordon. And joining me today is co-host Karen Gordon.
Hello.
And special guest, Walter Gordon.
Yeah, hi.
That was not very enthusiastic.
He's always that eloquent.
So today on Film Scene, we are going to talk about a single movie from 1984 from Studio Ghibli.
Well, it wasn't by Studio Ghibli at the time yet.
True, but it's always included in their collections,
right? Well, yes, they bought the rights after the fact.
This movie is called Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, directed by Miyazaki. The famous Miyazaki. That Miyazaki.
Hayao Miyazaki.
Recently retired Miyazaki.
Are we sure about that?
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah.
So the good English dub stars Alison Lohman, Shia LaBeouf, Uma Thurman, Patrick Stewart, Tress McNeely, Chris Sarandon, Edward James Olmos, and a host of others, including Frank Welker.
And Mark Hamill.
And Mark Hamill.
In a cameo.
Although I didn't recognize his voice anywhere.
Well, it was a very brief role.
So, Walter, why don't you hit up some of these plot points?
Well, the basic outline of the film is that it's a post-apocalyptic setting. It's sort of a science fantasy film, not so much in the vein of Star Wars. It's still fairly realistic stuff, but in terms of sort of a neo-medieval setting. And the basic plot of the film is that the human race is dying out because of a poisonous, toxic jungle that's spread after this implied nuclear holocaust, and it's up to the titular main character to basically save the day.
And I should say that like a lot of these Ghibli-style movies, there's a lot of animated human characters, which you don't get so much in American animated movies.
Yeah, it's a very human-centric film. There's no anthropomorphic characters at all.
And you also get a strong female lead.
Yes.
Which is also pretty typical of some of these Miyazaki films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pretty progressive.
Japanese stuff in general.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Ironically.
I suppose. What is the genesis of this whole thing? I believe I had somebody
well,
that told me.
What happened was the first film Miyazaki directed was part of another franchise called Castle of Cagliostro. It was so successful that he was asked to direct another film, but whatever company he was working for at the time refused all his suggestions for a film, and so they suggest instead he work on a manga, which became Nausicaä, the Valley of the Wind, which was released separately as a manga. The movie covers the first quarter of that manga because that's how much he had written at the time when he was asked to turn into a movie.
So what more could be in that story that's not in this movie?
Apparently the manga is a lot darker, and Nausicaä sort of changes her position that she comes to in the movie by the end of the manga, but, I mean, I've never read it, but I've heard it greatly expands the storyline, because it is a very distinct setting that's created.
So if he made this longer version...
Or a sequel.
Yeah, why did they never continue the film?
I'm not sure. I mean, like I said, I don't know terribly much about the manga, but, yeah, they just never did. They went on to do better things.
So I talked about the American dub, mm-hmm. which is the version that you can buy in the U.S. now.
The dub by Disney.
Right. From 2005.
Yes.
Does this Blu-ray also have the Japanese version, do you know?
Yes, it does. The only Disney Studio Ghibli release that does not have the authentic Japanese version is Castle in the Sky and Kiki's Delivery Service. The rest of them have faithful Japanese subtitles. But I mean, I mean, people are rather split about whether the subtitles are dubs or bar, but I mean, apart from slightly expanding the story, they're pretty much identical in terms of the content that's being delivered.
So I read that this was influenced by a variety of other fantasy and science fiction titles, like Earthsea.
Yeah, I mean, Miyazaki was a big fan of Earthsea, and he convinced Ursula K. Le Guin, the author of that series, to go give him the rights to go make a movie of that, but then he went on one of his many retirements and handed the project to his son, and the movie was critically panned for a Ghibli film.
Well, that sounds awesome.
I mean, I like the movie. I've seen it. I don't think it's as bad as people think it is, but it is not terribly similar to the books, and I guess for a Ghibli film, people were let down by that.
They also say it was influenced by Dune.
Yeah, you can definitely see that. I mean, although I'm not sure how familiar Miyazaki, how acquainted he was with it.
This also says Lord of the Rings, which I don't really get.
No, I do not see that.
Well, it was a journey.
Yeah, there's a journey film.
You want to talk about people walking in long places, that would be it.
Yeah, except there's not much walking in the film. There's a lot more flying.
There's a lot more flying. And I think this film, too, kind of shows Miyazaki's, I guess, fascination would be a word, with the concept of flight and, you know, aerospace. Not, that's not even the right word, but, you know, the flight engineering piece of it.
Yeah, what's that all about, anyway?
I don't know. It's just something he has a fascination with.
Well, he was born during World War II in 1941, so perhaps that was... and I know he explores that later in Spirit. What was the one that we just saw last year?
Wind Rises.
Yeah, Wind Rises, yeah. The Wind Rises was basically about that concept of flight during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese role in it.
Well, I like that he always draws these planes and gliders and things that would never really fly.
Well, how do you know that? I mean, because you've flown a lot of planes?
I think what's shown in the film generally could fly. I mean,
well, they look interesting, but I don't know how well they would actually fly.
I think they would fly.
They have these multiple layers of wings that don't really seem necessary.
Okay, some of them were kind of Howard Hughes-like.
Right, exactly.
You know, but at the same time, there's that... I think his concept of flight is interesting.
It's been noted before in the film, because in the film, the only real animals left are basically insects, that the design of the planes is no longer... influenced by birds, they're more similar to insects.
I think this film has a heavy environmental theme as well.
Oh yes, it definitely does. It's, you know, it's not...
it's Miyazaki's version of the Lorax, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not too ambilicious, though. It's pretty well done.
What does ambilicious mean?
Like, as in, if you do something bad, an anvil will drop on your head. Something that's very dastardly. Obvious, okay. Unearned moral, basically.
I can hear that.
Yeah, so where did the environmental message come from? Because this is was done in 1984, so that's pretty early.
Yeah, he's been pretty... I mean, I guess environmentalism is just something he's strongly been influenced by. I mean, Miyazaki has always taken generally some pretty socially progressive positions. He got into something of a controversy with Japanese nationalists because he does not like the current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's amending of the Japanese Constitution to let them send military forces overseas, as well as sort of whitewash the Japanese history. So I'm assuming it just had something to do with that. There's some very not too subtle allusions to nuclear warfare in the movie as well.
Well, yeah, the whole idea of a poison forest, basically.
Well, yeah, but I mean, especially so with the what are they called in the film? The giant warriors, whatever they're called.
What are they called?
I don't remember exactly.
Is that the Telemachans? No.
No, that's just
Telemachans.
That's just the enemy.
I really don't know what I'm talking about.
That's just one of the
enemies. Oh, were you talking about the Omashi? The bug things?
No, those are Oms.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Well, anyway, the giant warriors are rather clearly an allusion to nuclear warfare, because basically, in the film, they were what destroyed the world in the first place, and then it turns out one of the civilizations that has arisen in the aftermath of this has managed to reacquire one, and they're basically threatening to use it. But as it turns out through the film, they plan to use it to clear this poisonous forest, but it turns out that would, in fact, make things much worse.
Yeah, because the forest is actually able to cleanse itself, but no one knows that.
Yeah, the twist in the movie about halfway through is it turns out the poisonous jungle is really cleaning the world, and it's just the soil and water are so polluted that's what's causing the toxins to proliferate.
I'm reading it here, and it just calls them the giant warrior.
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of a Gollum type of character.
Yeah, basically.
Not from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it is very clearly like a Gollum in the sense of like the Jewish legend of like a giant being made of clay.
Well, I think it says a lot about the concept of humanity and that if we only change our own ways, that things could be much better. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting allegory. I'm also reading here that, and I can see this in some of his other films I've seen, that he does make several references to nature and ecology and pollution and humankind, even in films like My Neighbor Totoro and Spirited Away.
Well, yeah, I think all of them have, like, a strong environmental message. I mean, even Spirited Away, there's the scene with the river god who comes and is just horribly polluted.
But on a lighter note, he's a fan of Bugs Bunny. Sorry, just a random tidbit about Miyazaki. I know, sometimes you need to know that about people.
So one thing I like about this style of animation is that there's always points in these films where you could just freeze it and it looks like it would be perfect on a poster.
Well, and another thing that I'm seeing here is that he allows no more than 10% of his footage from his films to be computer generated.
Well, yeah, he didn't have any of his films computer generated until Princess Mononoke came out in 1996 because it was running so over schedule they finally brought in computer animators on portions of it. So, I mean, until the late 90s, basically, all of it was hand-drawn. Even then, most of it is still hand-drawn.
There's the part in this movie where Nausicaa is kind of out of the plane, but she's flying it with her feet. And she does, like, a thumbs up. And it looks almost like the nose art you would have on a bomber. You know, that pin-up
type of art. Oh, yeah. I guess I never thought about that.
I didn't notice that.
You have quite the eye for detail. I
think what's interesting about this style of animation in this particular film is that some of the later Studio Ghibli films have more of a 3D animation style. This is very clearly a 1980s sort of anime style that's done. It's rather flat and more grayscale. It's a lot closer in style to something that came out in the same time like Akira than some of the later Studio Ghibli films. It's rather stylistically distinct, basically.
Well, and don't forget the crappy Disney movies that were coming out in the 80s, too.
I like The Black Cauldron.
You did love The Black Cauldron when you were little.
I think it's a good movie. I think the problem was they cut out 15 minutes of it because they wanted to get a PG rating.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the original American cut?
Yeah, the original American cut was done in the mid-80s. It was called Warriors of the Wind. It was basically done because Miyazaki wanted money, and it was absolutely terrible.
And he hated the fact that they cut and chopped it so
badly. They tried to disguise the fact the main character was a girl because they thought it would alienate audiences. So on the poster art, Nausicaa isn't even visible, and they just have some random guy there. So they chopped it up in various other ways as well. I believe they removed something like half an hour to it. So basically, it was an in-name only cut of it. And this is the reason that Studio Ghibli films today that are being released have such faithful adaptations of them, because this one was so horribly done that he wouldn't license it to anyone else unless they followed these strict guidelines.
So they removed 21 minutes and 50 seconds.
And I'm seeing 25 minutes.
Oh.
So they cut out a significant chunk.
Yeah, and absolutely mangled the plot.
Oh, this is good too. It says the cover art for the VHS release have a cadre of male characters who are not in the film.
Well, think about the 80s, though. Who would you be marketing this film towards? We had a strong girl power thing going in the United States.
No, but there was still a significant market for that stuff. I mean, this was the time when, like, Akira came out.
I think you're forgetting about She-Ra, Princess of Power.
But only she came out because of the whole He-Man Masters of the Universe thing. So it was still a male-dominated concept, especially in the idea of cartooning at this time, you know, it's
cartooning.
There was still a market for it.
What would you
though?
Like me to call it? Animated film? I don't think people took animated film as seriously.
Oh,
yet.
They still don't take it seriously today.
Well, I think films, Miyazaki films, have helped break through some of that.
Yeah, but I mean, even then, they're usually in contrast to other films that it's introduced like that.
Well, and I think also it's, I think a lot of people think of animated as children's films only, and his films cut through that. And there's a good quote here that's attributed to Miyazaki, where he said, "I'm not going to make movies that tell children you should despair and run away." You know, the concept of portraying evil and then destroying it is considered mainstream, but I think it's rotten. you know, so the idea of good overcoming and still having hope is important. And I don't think that's just for children. I think this would be hard for a child to follow, quite frankly, but I think it's still entertaining for a child.
I don't think it would be that hard to follow. I mean,
it was hard for me to follow.
Yeah, but that's just kind of how you are.
Well, thank you.
I think part of the problem for people with these Ghibli movies is the plot isn't from point A to point B like it would be in an American movie.
It's much more convoluted. And
yeah. If
it were a live-action film, you might be able to follow it more. But because you are, I don't want to say distracted by the animation is beautiful, but I think that does force your eye in a different place and you're not thinking through.
Well, and I think some of it too is you don't have a reference, cultural reference point because you're not from Japan. For some of these things.
I mean, the only Studio Ghibli films there I've ever really seen any problems due to cultural differences are Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke, because those rely so much on Shintoist concepts that wouldn't be familiar to a Western audience.
Well, but in a movie like Totoro, though, has all these wood sprites.
Yeah, Totoro, too. Yeah.
I think Totoro is more child-friendly, but he also has another good quote here where he says, you know, I'm aware that there are spots where I'm going to lose the audience, and that's just magic, you know. You don't need to provide a necessary explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want that, you're not going to like my movie, and that's the way it is. I'm sure he says it much more eloquently in Japanese.
Or at least it sounds more.
It sounds much more beautiful.
So do you have any good fun facts about this movie?
Some interesting trivia about Nausicaa. Well, Walter made me aware of the fact that I had not even thought about it, and as many times as an English teacher as I've read through excerpts of Homer's The Odyssey, that the name Nausicaa came from a character in The Odyssey.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much that actually has to do with the plot of the movie, though. I think it was just
sort
of
a cool name.
Yeah, I think it was just sort of taken because it sounds good. I mean, Miyazaki did pretty much the same thing with Laputa in Castle in the Sky, which he had to change in Spanish language dubs because he didn't realize when he took it from Gulliver's Travels that it meant the whore.
Well, that can be quite interesting. Another fact here, the character Ubaba translates into English as great old woman, and personally I think they're saying Obama every time instead of
yeah,
Ubaba.
I believe the large insects in the movie that are called Om, I believe that translates to just bug in Japanese.
Yeah, great big insect.
Yes.
Very technical. One other interesting point, the military planes in the valley have the yellow wing-tipped undersides, which can be compared to the Nazi Luftwaffe. They also had similar markings during German invasions of surrounding countries. Another interesting fact, more than 56,000 traditional animation cells were used in the film. That just astounds me that someone would count that high, but I assume they have to number them to keep them in order. But just the sheer detail that they went through is kind of fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
What else would you like to know?
what else do you have?
Well, we did talk about how Miyazaki really took control of his work and stipulated that no edits aside be taken, even with a straight translation or a dub, that it needed to honor his work and that...
well, we also said at the beginning how this wasn't technically a Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah, it was released by the Toei Corporation originally, and then when they formed Studio Ghibli, they bought back the rights to it, which is why it's now released under the Studio Ghibli label. It was done by basically the same people who later formed Studio Ghibli, though. So, I mean, it's technically not, but it might as well be considered.
So was the success of this movie responsible for the creation of that studio?
Yes. After this movie, their first movie released under the Studio Ghibli label was Castle in the Sky. But yes, as far as I know, this movie was successful enough that enabled him to sort of strike out and start his independent career.
Yes. So can we have the talk that I really want to have about this film?
Maybe.
What talk is that?
Is she naked?
No, she is not.
It looks like there's all these butt shots of her. In fact, you keep telling me they're white pants, but...
They are, because I looked this up, and in fact, they are supposed to be white pants. Apparently, they have actually whitened the pants in later releases because enough people were confused, but it's supposed to be.
Well, it says she's wearing cream-colored trousers, but they don't look like trousers to me. It looks like she's fleshing her butt.
You can see it in some shots because there's, like, fabric bunching up under the knees.
Towards the end... I noticed that.
Yeah.
But early in the film, that was the first thing I think I said when watching
this the other
day. It's a
rather unfortunate color choice, but it's not too strange.
So Nausicaa's wearing this long coat.
Yes. Yeah. Well, not really long.
It's like a long coat.
Hip length, maybe. Yeah. With a skirt. Think of like a ice skater's outfit.
Well, and when she's flying with her glider, because it's billowing around, it makes it look like she's not wearing pants because they picked a bad color for her pants.
Yes.
They picked the worst possible color for a woman. It does look like a butt shot through the whole film.
It is not, though, as we
that's
have
what
confirmed.
That's what I hear, but And that's not a skirt. It's a jacket with a belt around it. And she's got, and I think, too, because she has these long boots on, it just looks like it should be a skirt.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was my burning question.
Wait, that's not a fun fact, is it?
It was a question that I saw here, you know, and I thought, you know
yeah,
what?
It's been asked enough that, yeah.
It makes you want to see the film just to see her.
I mean, it's
not debate,
are
those pants
impressive.
Or not. No, it's not that impressive. It's a young girl. It's no big deal, but it just makes you want to think, did they really do that on purpose?
Does it ever say how old any of the people here are supposed to be?
No, but I believe she's supposed to be a teenager or young adult.
Yeah, I'd say no older than 20. She's a princess, right? So she implying she's young.
Well, princess doesn't imply they're young. It just implies they're the son of royalty.
True, but how many Disney films do you know with old princesses?
Yeah, but this wasn't Disney.
It wasn't Disney, but Disney, you know what I'm saying. Again, name any film with an old princess.
Old
Sleeping
princess.
Beauty.
She was asleep. She's not that old.
Well, she's still old if she's asleep or not. You don't stop aging just because you're asleep.
But she didn't get old, is what I'm saying. These are the debates we have in our family.
So what else you got?
I don't know. This film has often been compared to the later film Princess Mononoke because they have extremely similar themes. Because the movies are both basically about... man's relationship to the environment.
Why do you think they did that?
Why do you think they did what?
Make a film so very much like Nausicaa.
Well, it's not too much like Nausicaa. It's just sort of a similar conflict that's presented. They have totally different settings because Nausicaa is in a post-apocalyptic sort of neo-medieval setting, whereas Princess Mononoke is in a historical period, which is Japan during the Warring States Sengoku Jidai period in the late 1400s.
What other fun facts did you find?
I think Miyazaki's just an interesting guy all around, aside from the movie. You know, like I said, he is a fan of Bugs Bunny. I think that says a lot about people. He is an Anglophile, which is also quite interesting. He has a degree in political science and economics, so perhaps that colors some of the more political tone in his work. I think that's quite fascinating. He is, even though he shuns the concept of computer-generated animation, he is said to be good friends with Pixar director John Lasseter.
Yes, that was in fact responsible for the reason that Disney has the rights to the Studio Ghibli dubs.
I know Lasseter was a big champion of Spirited Away when that first came out.
Yes. I mean, if you watch the non-Blu-ray cut of it today, it opens with John Lasseter talking about how great the movie is, basically.
Hmm. He is also a fan of Lauren Bacall. I find very interesting. She did the English voiceover of the Witch of the Waste in Howl's Moving Castle in 2004.
I didn't even notice that.
I know. So many of these voices seem so natural to the character, you don't stop and say, oh, that's Lauren Bacall.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that's Mark Hamill.
That probably works better in animation than live action when they try to do a dub.
I mean, some seem so out of place, though. They seem to be quite good at matching the voice to what they're intending it to do.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, most of the dubs are pretty much faithful exactly to the Japanese counterpart. The only Disney dub of the Studio Ghibli films that they changed any of the dialogue with was Castle in the Sky and Kiki's Delivery Service. And even then, the changes are so minor that you can pretty much ignore it.
Mm-hmm. An interesting side note to those things, though, that and this I never would have stopped to think about this. Two of the title characters have been voiced by Batman actors, not in this film, but in his other films. Michael Keaton and Christian Bale.
Yeah, I knew Christian Bale because Christian Bale basically does the Batman voice from Dark Knight and Howl's Moving Castle.
And what does that voice sound like?
I'm Batman.
There you go. I'm moving a castle.
Except...
I know. I know. I know he does not. I know he does not. You just sound like a barking dog.
That's what he sounds like.
Cancer.
Oh, he does not sound like a barking dog. Back to his political side, Miyazaki's political side, he refused to attend the 2002 Academy Awards out of protest over America's invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, I knew that.
Well, other people may not have.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, though. I heard that before.
You mentioned his connection to Ursula Le Guin's books, that he appreciates those quite much.
Mm-hmm.
Back to his aeronautical side, the name for Studio Ghibli came from an airplane, an Italian airplane, whose nickname was Ghibli. So again, his connection to flight is pretty well documented here.
And Italians.
And Italians, yeah.
I don't think the Italian connection is nearly as evident.
Well, it was in the film whose name I keep forgetting, The Wind Rises. Yeah, I don't know why that falls out of my head. But.
Yeah, the his counterpart that he kept dreaming about was an Italian airplane designer.
Well, I mean, it was in Porco Rosso, too, but that was coincidental because it was originally set in Croatia, but then the Yugoslav wars happened, so they changed it to Italy.
Interesting. I mean, he seems like such a fascinating guy.
Well, if you're interested, there is a streaming documentary right now. Do you recall the name of that?
Isn't that the one on Netflix?
Something of Dreams, I believe.
Yeah. I haven't watched it, but I know that it's there.
Something of Dreams. Well, you could look it up.
Well,
I mean,
well, I am.
It's about him and a couple of other Japanese animators, correct?
Well, it's the studio.
The studio itself. Okay. Which I have clearly
not seen.
Kingdom
of Dreams and Madness.
There you go.
I thought that's where I worked. No?
No. No, that's where I work. Especially the madness part.
So what is that the end of your fun facts for us?
I mean, that's quite a bit there. I mean, you know, we got a lot.
They say the film deserves a place on any shortlist of all-time classic anime movies.
I mean, I think just movies in general, it's probably one of the best I've ever seen.
Do you think it's the best of his work as well? Or
no, I mean, like I said, it's often been compared to Princess Mononoke. I think Princess Mononoke is the best movie he's done. I think the themes and story are a lot better in this, but I don't think the setting is as interesting as in Nausicaä. I think the setting in Nausicaä is a lot better. That being said, I still do prefer Princess Mononoke.
But is it better than Warriors of the Wind?
Well, I mean, it depends if you prefer awful, awful movies or not.
So in that version, they eliminated the main character from the poster and stuff.
Yeah. I don't think they eliminated her from the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, do they...
As far as I know, they didn't do that. They just horribly mangled the plot. So I mean, I don't see how you'd be able to do that, because then you'd have nothing linking any of the scenes together.
Did they chop it up to the point that she's more of a side character in that version?
As far as I know, no. I mean, I believe that she is still the main character. It was just really horribly done. I mean, they just changed a lot of the plot and stuff and mangled it.
She became Princess Zandra.
Yeah, I knew they changed the
really?
Title.
Oh, that's horrible.
The voice actors and actresses were not informed of the film's plot line, so it was one of those films.
What a mess.
Well, yeah, they changed the film's plot line to change the Ohms into just aggressive enemies instead of the more subtle relationship that's presented in the film.
They were ugly. I think any time, well, I think any time you use some type of bug or insect as your,
we all know antagonist, beauty is the standard for goodness.
Exactly, which is why you had a pretty girl in the role. Boom.
Boom.
Yeah, but I mean, the Ohms were clearly not supposed to be enemies.
Well, they could be if you found a way to anger them, clearly.
It's interesting in this movie as compared with Princess Mononoke that Nausicaa implies that sort of some symbiotic relationship can be formed with nature, whereas in Mononoke, it's a lot darker of a movie because the problem is sort of that the animals and humans and everyone else are so similar that it's going to breed more conflicts regardless.
Deep.
Was that the end of your trivia?
That was quite the end of my trivia.
Do you have any good goofs?
Not really. I don't think there's a lot of goofs in
animation.
Quality animation. Now, poorly done animation, I could see that. In quality animation, there's not too many goofs. There is a thing about the old lady, about her headscarf changing in a couple scenes back and forth from some crazy print to a different crazy print. But other than that, it's very straightforward and, not at all scandalous in any way.
Was that character supposed to be more relevant to a Japanese audience?
I don't think so. I mean,
old, wise lady.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Japanese tradition of, like the old hag or witch or whatever, which I think is equally relevant to a Western audience. I mean,
you old hag?
Well, it's the, should you fear her or, embrace her?
Well, someone that could kind of see into the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you need an omniscient.
The blind person that can see.
Yeah, someone who is, truth-seeking and can see beyond the BS because of age and wisdom.
So they didn't change the name in this cut?
Didn't change the name of what?
That character?
No.
Obaba?
Obaba.
Yeah, as far as I know, they didn't change any of the names of the characters.
A lot of times,
they all
sound
the same.
I don't know that they say some of the names either, They're just kind of there. Or is that just me?
I don't know what happens sometimes. I mean, like I said, the Disney adaptations are extremely faithful. They only really changed a couple of movies.
So did the...
this one?
No, they didn't change this one.
When they kind of took control of this stuff, did they re-release this to theaters? Or was this just for home video?
I don't believe they released this to theaters. The first Ghibli film, as far as I know, that was released theatrically was Princess Mononoke.
In the U.S.?
Yes, in the U.S. And that was basically released because it was such a large success in Japan and also because of the success of the Pokemon movie. Which was rather unfortunate because a lot of parents took their kids to see this thinking it was family appropriate and then apparently run out at the first scene when the guy's head gets cut off.
Yeah, it's quite a film. It opens kind of violently, but in general, it
Nausicaa,
seems to be.
You mean?
Yes, it seems to hit a really strong pacifist note at some point.
I mean, I think it's appropriate to show to kids. There's not really that much violence in it. Not gory violence, anyway.
Yeah, it's animated violence, so.
Well, I mean,
it doesn't make
compared
it okay,
with
but...
Princess Mononoke, where you have people severed limbs getting pinned to a tree.
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely not of that level. I would say if you were maybe 10 and older.
27.
This would 10, I think, is a good age. Because, by 10, you're already doing, and probably have done, years of play sword fighting and pirates and ninjas at this point. So you have some concept of the real idea of life and death.
But the Warriors of the Wind version was released to theaters, right?
Yes, it was in June 1985. I don't know how successful it was, but
the title.
I mean, but either way, Miyazaki was clearly nonplussed by it.
Nonplussed.
The VHS art looks like it should be on the side of an arcade game.
Yeah, it's very 80s He-Man aesthetic, basically.
80s He-Man aesthetic.
Well, just look at it,
I mean,
the guy up there is making the He-Man pose with a gun.
The guy up there would be the man in the middle of the poster art for those of you playing along at home.
Oh, I especially love the inclusion of the winged horse that appeared in the movie that didn't appear in the movie at all.
Yeah, I don't remember a winged Pegasus type.
Or any of these people.
Or any of these people, no. That looked nothing like the film.
Well, yeah, there's someone, to the poster's credit, there's someone on a glider in the back, and that's about the limit of the poster. It's faithfulness.
And it's faithful because it doesn't look like she's wearing pants there either.
Yeah. Well, even the monster on the poster doesn't look like the one in the movie.
Yeah.
It's true.
Maybe this was for a completely different film.
You think so?
Well, I mean, that was basically just the standard in the 80s in regards to adaptations of Japanese works.
Could be.
So what else do we have to say about Nausicaä?
I especially like the opening sequence over the credits, which is done kind of in the style of like an Lumet manuscript, which I thought is just very nice. Like, you could probably just show a movie of just that, and I would be satisfied. Well, no, not the credits themselves, but like the background that played over it that very effectively delivers sort of the exposition of the type of setting we're in.
So this is post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah.
How would you compare that to something like The Road Warrior, Mad Max, or other post-apocalyptic movies?
Well, first you've got to list one I've seen.
Yeah, you're the one person on Earth who has not seen the original Mad Max, probably.
I've not seen any of the Mad Max.
That's a function of your age, I think, that you have not seen those. I think this has a softer touch to it. I mean, Mad Max, again, is very male-driven, macho aggression, and I think this shows that a girl can be pretty badass without giving up the fact that she is a girl.
I mean,
she's not trying to be a boy. She's not trying to be a man in this world.
I mean, I think it's interesting because in a lot of ways it's more a more realistic treatment of sort of a post-apocalyptic world. It's clearly not just a vehicle for sort of a fantasy setting. Like, it clearly shows that there has been significant damage done to the Earth that, if it can be fixed at all, will take a long while to sort of fix.
And it'll take a woman to fix it. Because you men screwed it up. That's the whole point of the story.
Except one of the villains is a woman.
That's true. The one who reminds me of like a C-3PO hybrid.
Yeah, Uma Thurman's character.
Yeah, Uma Thurman's character who can take her limbs on and off. She was pretty skeevy. But I think, in general, for them to look at her as a princess but not think of her as a delicate little flower is important.
And then how about comparing it to some of these dystopian novels and movies like Hunger Games?
Nothing like it.
It makes Hunger Games look weak.
Well, that's not saying much, probably.
I mean, it's a dystopian setting in the sense of, like, an environmental catastrophe. It's not really a dystopian setting in the sense of, like, an oppressive government, although they're clearly, like, aggressive, invading peoples, but they're still presented in, like, a relatable manner. They're clearly not just a plot device to show evil or something.
Yeah, they don't really have political dealings going on here.
Yeah.
Well, they do, but they don't.
Well, they're political in the sense of environmental. They're not political in the sense of, like, socioeconomic issues that they're commenting on.
Well, I do feel, though, that they did make those who lived in the valley look like kind of bumpkins. For lack of a better word. I think maybe that's where relation to the concept of the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit comes into mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to compare the Valley of the Wind to like the Shire, but I think it was sort of presented in sort of a similar sort of idyllic fashion, and I didn't think they were being portrayed badly for their being rustic.
I mean, I think that, they were, rustic is a good word, and I think it was clear that they were trying to defend the world in which they were forced to live.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they might have been bumpkins, and there was a guy with a patch over his eye. Other than that, it was all good.
And they had crazy hats.
So they kind of had a pirate. Oh, they had totally crazy hats. And I didn't like the little breathers that they had to wear, because it looked like dog ears flapping up from them every time they inhaled and exhaled.
I mean,
but other than that, it was good.
I didn't have a problem with that part.
It looked a bit ridiculous.
Well, yeah, but then you could actually tell if they're talking, at least.
What was the name of that creepy gremlin on her shoulder?
You mean the fox squirrel?
It was just a thing.
I mean,
she tames it at the beginning after it bites her.
I noted before, the fox squirrel actually appears both in this film and in the next film, Castle in the Sky, which has led to speculation they're supposed to be set in the same universe.
I just thought it was creepy, but it didn't really, like, save her or do anything. It was just kind of there, which was okay.
No, it was just sort of like a companion.
Yeah, like, she needed a sidekick, but they didn't want to give her a human sidekick, so they gave her this thing that looks like a gremlin.
I didn't have a problem with it. It wasn't really distracting, and it was reasonably cute enough.
And she does have a weird relationship with animals.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's clearly part of the environmental theme, I think.
She's like the, you know, the horse whisperer, but without horses.
The bug whisperer.
The bug whisperer, yeah. Quite true. Mm-hmm. Much like you, Tim, whose cat, our cat, has just jumped into your lap.
The bug whisperer?
Yeah, you know, you're the cat whisperer. So.
So, what final thoughts do we have on Nausicaa?
See, there's our cat.
It's a really good movie that I would highly recommend. Yeah, definitely one of the best animated movies probably ever released.
You think this is like a good father-son movie to sit down and watch for like a not terribly young kid?
I mean, I wouldn't really call it a father-son movie. I think kids could watch it without any problem. I think they may not get some of the environmental overtones or the allusions to nuclear weapons, but I mean, yeah, there's nothing really bad in the movie. It's a pretty compelling movie, I think.
But you feel like as a family film, someone could take everything, I mean, anything from it.
Yeah.
It's entertaining for adults and children alike is what I'm attempting to say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's swords and stuff, so.
So that's why you loved it. How old were you when you first saw this?
1.5.
This year.
Okay, then.
So,
well, how old were you when you saw your first Miyazaki film, though?
Probably the first one I saw was Spirited Away, and it was kind of terrifying, so. But
well, you would have been about 5 or 6 years old when that came out.
I would have been about 5 or 6, but I don't think I saw it till I was about 8, so.
So at 8 years old, that was, Spirited Away was too much for you.
I mean,
do you think at 8 years old
it was a good movie,
so
I just didn't really get it, and it was kind of terrifying. I mean,
okay.
I don't know, maybe Japanese children are much more
familiar
with that.
Or perhaps it is good to have a family film like this so you can talk about it.
Yeah.
Is it probably less family-oriented than Kiki's Delivery Service?
Yeah.
Totoro?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, nothing really happens in Totoro, so.
So, anything else? No.
I think it's good for me.
You have nothing to say about it? No.
Well, no. I think, like I said, I think it's a good family-type film. It's not my favorite Miyazaki film, but I can start to see how his other films since then have tied together somewhat. I'm still a Totoro fan.
I'm not.
And Ponyo. Nothing like a little girl who has gills.
Well, I think that's going to do it for us then.
Okay.
If you have any questions or comments, write to us at film.scene@yahoo.com. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/filmscenepodcast. We're also on Twitter @filmscene1. And don't forget about our half.com store, too, for great deals on books, movies, music, and games. Click on shops in the bottom left corner and type in TGOR1. And don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, I'm Tim.
I'm Karen.
Walter.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Bye-bye.